Hi, this is Adam, and welcome to the African Pre-Seed Podcast. If you're a founder or investor keen on learning more about the African tech ecosystem, you've come to the right place. In this episode, we are focusing on the grey matter, and by grey matter, I mean the physical tissue that makes people what they are, the brain, and how best to optimize mental wellness and performance. To help us understand how, I am in the very privileged position to welcome clinical neurologist and founder of Memorability.co, Dr. Kirti Ranchod. Dr. Ranchod, thank you so much for joining us on the African Pre-Seed Podcast. How are you? How is 2024 treating you?
Thank you, Adam. It really is a pleasure to be here. It's been a good start to the year, and let's hope it carries on that way.
Yes, you mentioned to me off year that you have the habit of having worked over the festive season, but you haven't in recent years. How does it feel being dislocated from your normal schedule in December?
What I think happens, though, is that you revert back to the habits you know. So it was so normal for me to work over Christmas and New Year. So, yeah. So and it was good to prepare. So I feel prepared for the year, basically.
Oh, excellent. Yeah. Okay. Otherwise, you never, no holiday, no preparation. You just keep going. If you looked up Dr. Ranchod, you'd learn at minimum the following. Dr. Ranchod holds an MBBCH in medicine and an FC neurology from the University of the Witwatersrand in Johannesburg, and is an Atlantic Fellow for Equity in Brain Health, studying at Trinity College in Dublin. Dr. Ranchod is chair and co-founder of the Africa Brain Health Network and honorary lecturer in the Department of Internal Medicine at Alma Mater Wits, a past board member of Alzheimer's South Africa, and as noted most recently, the founder of Memorability.co. I've left some things out too. I remember looking at your LinkedIn profile and I thought there's a lot going on over here, which is why I'm also so excited to speak to you. But quickly, before we move into our icebreaker, can you please tell us a bit more about Memorability.co? What is it about? What do you do?
So Memorability actually started because, as you mentioned, I'm a neurologist, so my focus is on the brain. And initially, you look at brain and you look at illness. And at some point, I realized that wasn't enough. I wanted to sort of give people something more than just managing the illness. How do we reduce the severity? How do we make people healthier? How do we prevent? And so I started looking at the field called brain health. And so I started Memorability to actually give myself the space to develop and promote brain health solutions for people to actually reduce the risk of illness and function better in the world, because that's what a healthy brain does. I will say about starting it, though, it may be one of the most challenging roles I've had, but potentially more than even being a clinical neurologist. So, yeah.
I think our listeners and founders will be very pleased to hear that, because I'm not a founder myself. I'm very lucky to work with a lot of them. It's really, really hard. So that's what we try to do here at the podcast, to try to provide insights. And I think trying to optimize brain health, I'm a big fan of mental health, speaking about it. So I'm very excited to just price information from your experience. And I also, I assume you get asked this a lot because you are, you know, qualified neurologist. Why does the brain fascinate you? Has it always fascinated you?
I think it has always fascinated me to a certain extent, but I think you make certain decisions when you're younger and they shape the way you think and the way you view the world. I did neurology in my fifth year medical school as an extra subject because I needed more time in this field. And when I went to do this, I was like, oh, this is absolutely fascinating. Neurology as a field is very analytical, very logical. You're solving a puzzle and then you're helping the person. So that's what inspired me to get into the field. But once you start in the field, then you start, like if I go to an art gallery, I'd be like aware of what it's doing to the way I'm thinking, you know. And so you start then looking for the science behind that. And so that's how it shapes how you view the world, basically.
I assume, I mean, Jason, our sound engineer here, when he listens to everything, I know he'll pick up things that since he knows how it's manufactured or how it works, similar to me when I read something, and having worked in journalism before, you know how the sausage is made, to put it in quite crude terms. And it changes your view of everything because you see the inner workings. But I do hope you can still go to art galleries and enjoy it. I think I'm not very good at looking at art. It's meant to be an immersive experience. So I hope you get better luck going forward. But I think that offers us the perfect moment to play just a quick game of Rate This.
Rate this, rate this, rate this, rate this.
I'll share three topics with you. When you hear them, please share your gut reaction and your rating on each one between 1 and 5, and in a sentence of why you gave it that rating. 5 is the highest rating you can go, the highest level of praise. So are you ready to play?
I am.
Okay, great. So it's just three very quick options. The first one, I'm being a bit naughty because you study medicine, you have to do an insane amount of reading in doing so. So the Amazon Kindle?
Three.
A three? Do you own a Kindle?
No.
No? Do you prefer the tactile touch of a book?
I do. Okay. I think I learn better, I study better, I remember better. But I do think it's useful. Like I see people, particularly who are older, who can now increase the text size and can read with so much ease. So it's definitely a use, but I don't use it.
I'm the same as you. Like, I actually prefer reading printed materials. Clearly, I'm old, even though I'm not that old. I've only started doing this recently, using your phone to pay for things, tapping your phone.
So I would say no as well, like not for me personally. Mm. And again, I think it's about having everything on this one device. Like I can't understand, I guess I don't get the why. I don't understand why I should if I have a card.
Yes, I kind of agree with you. I know my bank changed the reward structure to encourage people to tap their phone more. And I don't understand why.
Yeah.
Like, I know I'm not alone. Because even my dad in his 60s, he's tapping his phone. And I'm again, maybe I'm being left behind. You're making me feel a lot better. Now, lastly, the sporting craze that appears to have been taking over certain parts of Johannesburg anyway. You look left or you're walking down the street, you're walking to a paddle court. Your thoughts on the game of paddle?
It seems to be really exciting. I haven't tried it yet, but I know lots of people who have. So I am keen to actually go. So hopefully somebody can invite me and we'll go.
Okay. So I'll give that a rating of three. And then with tapping your phone, a 1 to 2.
Yeah.
If it can be accurate like that. Okay, great. Thank you so much for playing and making me feel better as well.
Rate this. Rate this. Rate this. Rate this.
But now, without further ado, I'm just going to go on to my first question, and it's a two-parter. What does mental well-being mean to you when you hear the term? And if we take the popular understanding of what mental well-being entails, do you think enough attention is given to the actual biology of the brain itself when discussing mental health?
So let's go to the first part. What do you think mental well-being is? And I think it really, we have to start thinking about it in a way that's not only about our mood, how we're feeling, or that we're not depressed, or that we're not anxious. But we have to start thinking about it in a more whole sense. And it's because it allows us to function well in the world, right? So it's not about what we should avoid. It's not about not being sad. It's not about not getting angry. But we have to start thinking about it, like I said, in this holistic manner as to how we want to function and what does mental wellness actually mean for us, for those healthy relationships, etc. And so that's the way I would look at it in terms of that. So the biology is important, and it is the part that I do focus on in terms of bringing the neuroscience. So what happens when we mentally well, how does that actually affect brain performance and what changes in the brain specifically? But again, if you consider the whole, the biology is one aspect of mental wellness. So you have to consider person, person in environment, ecosystem around the person. And I think once we start doing that as an approach, we'd have better approaches to mental health. But yes, my focus is on the brain and the brain tissue.
Yeah, well, that's interesting. I think you talk of mental well-being, it is addressed in a very individual setting. And I imagine people would say, oh, go speak to someone, which is, I'd always advise that. But when at times people often forget to note the context in which a person is. But then just to ask a follow-up on that, then do you think enough attention is paid to that context specifically? Or is it very much about, oh, you're the individual? You can fix your mental health just by yourself versus ignoring the context around you, just based on your experience and what you've seen in your field.
Both are important. So we all have agency and there's specific measures that we can take as individuals, irrespective of our context. But there has to be approaches to actually look at the context as well. So as an individual, you may not be able to change everything in your environment. Mm-hmm. So you have to focus on yourself. But from a policy point of view or from a public health point of view, we need to consider the whole and how that is actually shaped. Personally, also, in terms of what we can do in terms of that shaping the whole, it's who you spend time with, how you spend time with them. What are you doing with your free time in terms of the social aspect of it, the spiritual aspect of it?
Very quickly, why is it important? How important is it to mental health?
To mental health, absolutely essential. So in terms of having good social support networks, not large necessarily, but feeling loved and supported, actually changes the brain in phenomenal ways. So when I started reading it, I started actually looking at dementia prevention. And I thought you just feel better. And because you feel better, you stay healthier. That's actually not what happens. The science behind it is just, it's just absolutely fascinating. So when you feel loved and supported, a specific gene is switched on. So we do inherit genes, but depending on certain lifestyle factors, these genes can be switched on or off. So when we feel loved and supported, a specific gene is switched on that releases a factor in the brain that supports growth and development of the memory and mood part of the brain. So feeling loved and supported actually changes the physical structure of the brain, helping us to reduce anxiety, reduce depression, reduce risk of dementia. So pretty phenomenal when you think about it.
I was going to ask, I mean, at a high level, if you could break down the different parts of the brain relevant to mental performance, but it seems to be a bit more detailed than that. You have the physical structures of the brain, but it's almost how they're affected by the outside environment. Am I describing it in a way that makes sense?
Yes, and so both are true. There are specific parts of the brain that do that have specific functions. There's integration that is important as well across the brain. And then there are the external factors that have such a profound impact on the brain, which is why we need to consider the ecosystem as well.
Understood. And just to go into the biology of it, which parts are most critical? Forgive me if it's all of it. I know nothing about brain biology, but in terms of our subject today, which parts of the physical brain are most relevant to your work and your focus on mental well-being?
Yeah, so it is the whole brain in essence, just because there's different parts that do different things. So for example, the frontal lobes, the front of the brain, would be important in reasoning, memory, judgment. And what's fascinating about that, when do you think it switches off? Reasoning, memory, judgment?
My gut feel was when you sleep.
When you fall in love.
Oh.
Isn't that fascinating? Doesn't make perfect sense. Yeah, so different parts of the brain do different things and you need everything to function differently depending on what you're doing, right? So, for example, in taxi drivers, it's a very famous study. Taxi drivers in London, pre-phones, so they had to know the city and they had to navigate the city. Yes. They had to understand where traffic was. The parts of the brain that were responsible for spatial navigation, navigating through a city, were more developed. Makes perfect sense. Yes. So what is important is what you need to do, right? Yeah.
Okay. So... And actually, I've watched a documentary on the taxi drivers pre-phone. It's actually really fascinating. I can't remember what they're called. It's almost a workout for the brain, depending on the environment that you do.
Mm-hmm.
Someone who speaks a lot for the living, that part of the brain that handles that function will be more well-developed as of going to gym.
Exactly.
If I could put it that way. Okay, that makes a lot of sense, actually. Okay, you're making me feel a bit better because I was terrible at biology. Also, I'm like, okay, this is really, really interesting. Case study time. I'm a founder of a startup in Tunis. And I want to optimize my brain performance so that I can give myself the best shot possible of scaling my startup. I want to be at my very best. Where would you start? What process would you kick off? If there's a way to approach it in a very step-by-step way of trying to think about how can I be the very best I can be from a mental performance point of view?
So the way I approach it is to think about it as brain skills. And that's what I've incorporated into my system at Memorability. So I use a specific brain skills model to actually train the brain. And so if you think about it like any skill, like we were saying, taxi drivers, musicians, you know, whatever you actually do is going to shape your brain. So if you look at brain skills for entrepreneurs, I would put creativity, empathy, focus, and calm as potentially core skills. There's 8 brain skills in my model, but potentially starting with those 4 brain skills. And given the level of stress within an entrepreneurship journey, and the level of stress currently just in general, I think calm is foundational currently. When you look at stress management techniques, but beyond stress management, you're actually developing the neural circuitry for calm. Why is that important in terms of an entrepreneurship journey? Because there's several studies that actually show that people who meditate are more creative. And it's about what's shifting in the brain in terms of that. So how your brain becomes more efficient in terms of shifting between different circuits, and meditation potentially encourages that to develop. Or problem solving. So when you're looking at scaling a business, you're going to get really stuck at some point and you're going to sit. I mean, we've all done this, right? No matter what field we've been in, we've sat there for 4 hours and tried to figure it out, as opposed to taking a break and going out to spend some time in nature, going for a walk, coming back, and then problem solving. Just doing that actually improves your ability to problem solve. So fascinating research, and there's several, but I'll quote the one. is they compared two groups of students. And the one group, so they both start with a set of problems to solve. Then they separate the group of students into two groups, and the one group gets a meditation exercise. They both then attempt to do those set of problems that they couldn't solve for the second round. The group that meditates 20 minutes actually can solve the problems better. So when you just think entrepreneurship journey and you're stuck, and if you just have a good practice that helps you to feel calm, you could potentially improve what you actually create in many different ways.
So I was going to be cheeky and say procrastination sometimes in the right context and done in the right way can be helpful. I mean, you mentioned calm, and I tend to write a lot in my work. If I'm stressed, I do not write well. Hence, I tend to write better at night when the environment is calm. How can you create that calm? I know you gave the example of going for a walk, and calm represent different things for different people. Or is there a set guidebook of what is a calming environment? Does it kind of depend? So,
nature, for the most part, for most people, depending on environment. So obviously, if you go to an area that's not safe for any reason and it's natural, you're not going to feel calm, right? But nature specifically as a whole does help people to feel calmer. But then it's about understanding yourself and understanding the activities or the spaces that help you to feel calm. As you described, sitting quietly in the evening does help you to feel calmer. So mindfulness or meditation is one of the most popular activities, or particularly in popular media. It is effective, it is helpful, but it doesn't work for a large subset of people, right? And in part, it's because of a certain aspects in terms of the way it gets taught. But what people need to do is understand the impact of certain practices. Like, what is happening to you? Do you feel calm? Do you feel that you could think better after doing it? And then that's the activity you actually do. So the way I approach it is I give people several different tools with a guided process to understand the impact that it has on you. And from that, then you actually select the tools that are going to help you most. And I tie that into the actual experience, so the calming experience, but also in terms of the impact that it has on what you are thinking and the impact that it has on what you do. So the way I facilitate the process is so that you directly understand the impact that it has on you and then what you can take forward beyond the actual class.
Almost building that muscle of self-reflection, which is quite hard. I mean, you always think about the right thing to say in the moment after the moment has passed,
exactly.
If I can describe it that way. Okay, that's really interesting. You've given me a good way to ask about what parts of modern life, I think a busy city, for example, not the most calm environment, do we underestimate or not recognize as drags on our mental health and brain function? And even day-to-day examples that you wouldn't think are negative for our brains.
I think lack of sleep is the big one. And yeah, I think we are sleeping less, and that's what most studies have shown. We have lots more distractions, particularly with our phones. And I think we all have that habit when we can't sleep, we reach for this distraction, whereas before you just sit there and hope you fell asleep, and eventually you would.
Yes.
So sleep is a big one. Food is the other big one. When you actually look at how our diets have changed and the impact that actually has, again, on brain tissue. So diets high in saturated fat and high in refined sugar, after just 2 weeks, change the structure of the brain. Same process as I was describing earlier. So it switched that specific gene off and therefore reduces plasticity, which is the ability of the brain to grow and adapt and learn, after just 2 weeks. So then it affects memory, it affects learning, it affects problem solving. And again, in these busy lifestyles, we end up going for what is convenient.
Yes.
What is convenient is not necessarily what is healthy. And the third one is technology. Particularly social media, or even our paying with our phones, etc. Not necessarily paying with our phones, but our dependency potentially, and how that is affecting our ability to form healthy relationships, right? Our normal engagement would have meant that I would speak to somebody in a store to find out what I needed to get. Now I go onto a phone, I don't speak to anybody. I potentially lose this ability to communicate, right? How does that then transcend into different relationships when we need to communicate, when we need to share, when we need to express vulnerability? And I think long-term, we've seen it already, but I think long-term, that's the potentially the biggest negative, and something we need to start looking at how we how we mitigate against, how do we protect against the changes that are going to happen in our social culture because of how we've changed interacting with each other.
I was thinking, you think you're communicating with someone using your phone, but it's a very much of a lower quality versus doing so in person. I may not go to this person's birthday function, but I can just message them as I'm too busy. Mm. While interacting them with in person, beyond just being, I guess, the nicer thing to do, has material benefits from a socialization and brand function point of view. If I'm kind of hearing you correctly, i.e. the loss of sense of community is happening as we speak due to just the modern life, if that's a fair way to put it?
Yeah, so community and communication. I give the other example. Mm. Before, I would have to ask somebody for directions.
Yes.
I never have to do that anymore. Asking for somebody for directions was one of the simplest ways to express vulnerability, understand who to trust, who to approach. Subtle things that we learned with this everyday ordinary experience that we just don't have anymore. And it's, yeah, just to consider the impact that it has on us.
And it's worse for, maybe not, but in a tech-oriented environment, tech-oriented founders, you are driven to embrace technologies. Thank you. That's really, really insightful. So I hope our listeners think about that. I know from a diet perspective, what I'm hearing is fast food. We know it's not good for you. Sugars, sugary drink, sweets, biscuits, the odd one won't do any harm, but in excess can actually be very, very damaging beyond just our physical bodies, but mentally too. Mm. Okay. Note taken. Founders lead hectic lives. You've already answered some of this. Mm. What three tips would you give that they can implement almost immediately that would make a difference to their mental state and brand performance in the short to medium term? If it means repeating yourself, please do, because I think it's very valuable advice for the founders.
I think the first thing is to find a practice that helps you to feel calm and to understand the correct time for you to use this. So is it before you're going to start a complex task? Is it before you're going to start a creative task? Is it going to help you to communicate with your team better? So understand the time and also the activity. So there's meditation, mindfulness, and there's different ways to approach it, like relaxation. And yeah, there's a host of ways to do that, which I do as well. The second thing is diet. So I think this is so critical, and you have to plan, right? On one of my jobs, I had this exceptionally busy day. I knew I was going to finish between 6 and 8 o'clock in the evening, depending on how busy I was. And I had a smoothie. I prepared the smoothie every day that I would have at 5 o'clock because I knew that I needed something to take me beyond that. I also knew I would have my second chocolate of the day if I did not have it. You know, so I had my first chocolate already, but I needed to prepare for a busy day, understanding what I would do if I wasn't prepared. So it's about how do you prepare? If you don't have the time, how do you find help? Whether that's somebody in your personal space or somebody that you know, paying for, but how do you actually prepare to have the healthy food and then not to neglect sleep? Yes, I have, it is repetition, but it's so critical. And when I see or, you know, interact in these entrepreneurial spaces, that's what I've identified in terms of people not sleeping, too much caffeine, which means you don't sleep. That's a knock-on effect.
I was going to ask you then about sleep. And I do know within most medical practitioners, you do work insane hours and lack of sleep, and poor mental well-being, ironically, is a huge problem within the medical fraternity worldwide. Just some tips on sleep and how to approach it. And even in terms of caffeine intake, when should you be having that last cup of coffee or tea, for instance? And what other things can one do to improve your sleep? I think in the context of maybe you only got 5 hours, I don't know, but what can you do to ensure that the sleep you are getting, beyond A, trying to get as much of it as possible, is quality sleep? What steps would you advise?
Caffeine is, people vary in terms of the impact of caffeine on them. So again, in part to understand yourself, but if you're not sleeping well, to try and not have any caffeine after 2 o'clock in the afternoon.
Two. But yeah, sorry.
And that's not where you should have 5 cups before 2. You know, it's doing moderate even before 2 o'clock.
Okay.
But it's if you're not sleeping. There are people who can and can still sleep. But if you're not, try to avoid it. The second thing would be to exercise regularly. So exercise has been shown to actually improve sleep. The third thing we come back to is effective technique to help you to calm down. Is there something you can do before you sleep, a short relaxation experience or exercise that will help you to sleep better? So that's the way to think about sleep, not to eat too late. So you need to eat 2 to 3 hours before bed and to try to keep your room quiet and calm with minimum distraction. So potentially to leave your phone somewhere else, which probably makes us more anxious. But anyway, those are the strategies to sleep better.
I read too.
Yeah.
It's a habit I'm still not quite getting right, but I assume I'm tiring out my brain. I generally do sleep better. So I feel like I'm on a good wicket.
Mm-hmm.
We had a great conversation just about the ethics of running a startup and what founders should keep in mind about the duty of care. I know it's a term you're very familiar with within your work within the medical field and even working in journalism. I don't know what words they are to describe it. I can't recall them now, but there's a similar concept that should be applied when one is reporting about someone else's life. And I do say that in air quotes. And with founders, they owe their customers, given VC's focus on scale and growth, that duty of care. What do you mean by duty of care in detail? This thought was a really interesting chat that we had. I know it's something that you are particularly interested by.
So yes, I start out as, you know, in medical school. By second year, we introduced the concept of first do no harm, right? And it's ingrained in your thinking framework. First do no harm, and then how do you help people, right? And there's also specific ethics courses that you actually have to do throughout medical school. And it does shape the way you think in a certain way. So I'm not saying all health professionals are ethical. But even if you're not, I think you're sort of conscious that you're not ethical on some level. But what I find in many other spaces, not just in the entrepreneurship spaces, is that this is not actually built into the system. And I find that when I go to a lot of the entrepreneurship spaces, a lot of the business models that are quoted are potentially not ethical. They're exploitative. Like, all of us understand they're exploitative, there's no doubt. But these are the models that keep getting quoted. And that puzzles me in a way. Like, you have this opportunity to potentially shift the way we approach entrepreneurship and creating value in a business so that it's still profitable, but not necessarily exploitative. And that's what I found a little bit interesting or disturbing.
So if that's a systemic challenge, and I do hear you that it probably happens across all fields, if you're in law or I don't know about engineering, my father's an engineer, so they seem pretty straight-laced and forward. Where do you think you can then tackle that systemic problem from an education point of view, to use that word, or where can we instill this understanding of the duty of care one has to their customers on the entrepreneurship journey? Do you think it should be taught, for example, at business schools? But a lot of entrepreneurs don't go to business school. Where would you even start? So it's a very broad question, but I'm just very interested to think where do you think we can start to try make founders and entrepreneurs, if they're not already, conscious of what they should be doing in terms of the people that they're meant to serve and the value they're meant to be creating in the societies they work in?
I think one thing I want to add also to that is most of the entrepreneurs I meet, particularly, I mean, it's only in South Africa, are trying to solve a very real world problem.
Yes.
Whether it's in health, whether it's in economics, whether it's food security, you know, they're solving a real world problem. So there is ethics in that already, right? But what I think is that we need to start reflecting on examples that already do that. So which are the ethical business models? That's what I'm curious about. What are the ethical business models that potentially could be replicated that are not exploitative? And if those examples get shared more frequently, what would change?
Systems change through communication and sharing of information. Dr. Ranchod, we have run out of time, but I just want to say, I could pick your brain, pun intended, for a very, very long time. But my producer is giving me the time's up sign. Just, I want to thank you so much for sharing your time with Insight with us on the African Pre-C podcast. We very much appreciate it.
Thank you, Adam. I hope this helps the entrepreneurs out there.
It really should. Based on our discussion, if you have been listening, please apply Dr. Ranchod's advice. And last one to you. If people want to find out more about memorability.co, and it is in the name to a degree, but where can they learn more? How can they reach out to you, contact you?
Yes, to go to my website, it will explain everything that I do. There's online courses that actually do what we were discussing in terms of calm and different approaches, including using art. I would recommend it to you, Adam. But yes, feel free to contact me also. My email is kirti@memorability.co.
Okay, well, there you have it, straight from the source. Please get in touch if you have any queries. And lastly, thank you to all of you, our listeners, for joining us today. Let us know what your thoughts are and how you identify the challenges that we're solving, the places you call home, but doing so in an ethical manner. and making sure you can find calm in your own environment. I think that's probably the theme of this episode. How do you find calm? Send your thoughts, please, to hello@africanpreseed.com and also share them with us on social media using the African Preseed Podcast hashtag. That's it for now. We'll catch you on the next one. Cheers, everyone.